Taxation is theft.
Please, at least leave us alone in our living room.
My job is to find the truth.
Double the taxes.
I'm a human being. God damn it. My life has value.
Triple the taxes.
This is an IRS agent's dream.
If you think that the Capitol will ever treat us fairly, you are lying to yourself.
Beautiful, lovely taxes.
Sorry, but I don't do taxes.
Did you see the memo about this?
The government is a greedy piglet.
Just leave us alone.
Do you know what Ralph just said?
The roads.
You boys like Mexico?
I'm as bad as hell, and I'm not gonna take this anymore.
All right, welcome back. Taxation is theft. And I have with me today Dave Champion, who is an awesome author of a very awesome book. He is, I would call him an expert on the income tax. Is that fair?
It is. Well, at least an expert at to whom Congress has imposed it and who not.
All right. So, so we're always talking about taxes, of course. The show is called Taxation is Theft. And I picked up this book a while ago. I've been following you for a while, actually. So it's really an honor to be talking to you. And I know you've made on your Facebook channel, you've done a lot of videos just kind of on all government topics in general. But eventually I picked up this book that you wrote, and I was just like blown away by it, because I'd been following Irwin Schiff and Joe Bannister and some of these other names for, you know, almost a decade now, maybe a little bit longer. And, you know, it was really great information, but it was still really hard to kind of understand. And then I read this book and I was like, you did a really great job at kind of like going through it step by step and really making sense out of it. So thanks for writing that.
Well, thanks for saying that. You made my month just by saying that I wrote it in such a way that everybody could understand, because that's exactly what I set out to do. So thank you.
Awesome. Yeah, it's a really interesting and really confusing topic. And of course, you know, I'm running for president as the president who wants to get rid of all taxes. And of course, I get hit with all these questions all the time. Okay, but how are we going to build roads? What about the poor and all these other things? So we'll get into some of those questions later. But I kind of want to start out and ask you, you know, what's kind of your history? How did you get into learning all of this? What set you off on the path to want to learn so much about the fascinating income tax? You know, it's not something that everybody wants to learn more about.
No, and if I wasn't such an obstinate son of a bitch, I wouldn't have either. What happened was I owned a business, and probably like most business people, I had absolutely, if it said IRS, I didn't want anything to do with it. So I had an accountant on retainer. And whenever I would get an envelope like that, here, Ira, you fix this for me. I got things to do. Presuming he was earning his keep. I mean, he was on a monthly retainer, right? Well, I walked into the bank one day, and the bank teller, one of them who I knew very well, as I walked up to the window, she started crying. And said, oh, my God, Dave, I had to do it. Do what? She had given the IRS, based on an IRS levy, $32,000 out of my payroll account. That money that belonged to my workers, that they had already earned, okay? So needless to say, I had something to say to the accountant, what the hell is going on? I've trusted you. I put this in your hands. And I quickly realized that I was in a position I didn't find enviable, which is I had these people coming after me, taking my property, attacking me. I had hired the very professional that society tells you to go out and hire, a certified public accountant. And I realized I knew absolutely nothing about my adversary other than the letters IRS. And I'm a former cop and a former Army Ranger. And the idea that some entity that I couldn't really identify was able to walk up and, to be crass, kick me in the nuts, that was a big no-go for me. So right. That started my research.
Awesome. Yeah. And it's, you know, that makes a lot of sense, because I've kind of always been wanting to start a business, and that's kind of where I got hit with it too. And I actually got hit with the same thing where, you know, they went and just took money out of my bank account. And this might actually be a really good topic to just jump into some of the tax code. At the time, I don't remember who it was, but I looked at the form that they sent to the bank, and on the back, they had like they had the codes that were that talked about the bank levy, and it was like they had section A, section B, and section D, and they totally skipped section C, which was the one that required that form to be signed by a judicial officer or a judge.
Well, they also leave out the part about, you know, who it actually applies to. They don't ever put that far, right?
Right. So,
and by the way, let's just say, let's get this right out of the way. The banks know everything that's in my book. The banks are co-conspirators in this felonious conduct. Now, not the people that are sitting in the bank. So if you've had something like this happen, don't run in and tell the gal that's behind the desk, you know, you dirty rotten so-and-so, you stole my money and you're a co-conspirator.
Right.
The people at the top, the highest levels of the bank, the legal department, the VP of their legal department, know everything that's in that book, and they are felonious co-conspirators.
Now, for them, this is an interesting question because a lot of people hate bankers and they hate banks because these evil banks with their overdraft charges and fines and interest rates and everything else. Do you think that a lot of those people are doing this because they've got friends in the IRS, or are they doing it because basically the federal government has the power to shut down a bank? Like, you know, they regulate who gets to stay in business as a bank or not. Is it something where they benefit, or they're just kind of afraid of the IRS also?
I don't know if it's an afraid equation. When you get into corporate law at that level, okay, because obviously banks are some of the largest, most prestigious, most powerful corporations in America. When you get to that level, the belief system of the top lawyers, the people who advise the CEO and the board members, their ethos is, and then I've actually sat down and talked to Harvard Law grads and had them tell me this is what they're taught in places like Harvard Law. When the government says this and such, just do it. If you want a problem, screw around. If you don't want a problem, just do it. And so that's the mindset of the attorneys at that level, or maybe I should say down here, because if you're just a compliant little sniveling weasel, you're down here, you're not up here, okay? But that's the outlook of corporate attorneys in every industry at that level.
Right, and that seems to be the case too, like when, you know, so I kind of studied a lot of these like online law schools, like Harvard would record a lot of their courses and students would post them online. And I would really see a lot of that in there where they'd say, these are the case laws and these are the outcomes, so this is this. And I would sit there thinking like, but wait a minute, that doesn't really make sense. That doesn't sound moral or ethical. But it's like they're teaching it as that's just the way it is. And I never really hear much about like, yeah, so if you wanted to challenge this, you know, these are the holes in this case. Or you know, you never really hear that. So it really is kind of just like what you're saying.
And years ago, I don't know if they still do this because social media is so huge now. I don't know if it's possible. But you know, if you go back 20 years ago, the Treasury Department had in-house attorneys functioning as trolls out on the internet. And it would be great because I would like post a citation for a case, the relevant quotes that I wanted to direct people's attention to and what point that was supposed to make to them. And literally, I'm not kidding, Matt, within 3 minutes, one of these trolls would come on and say, "You're wrong, Mr. Champion," and provide 7 or 8 case citations. It's like, oh, in 3.5 minutes, how did you do that if you're just an ordinary citizen, right? But here was the kicker. This goes to your story, what you're telling. If you took the time, which 99% of the people did not, if you took the time to pull those cases, they were all off point.
Right.
To muddy the waters, to get people, no, that one guy with the 7 or 8 cases, he must be right. But all the cases were off point.
Right. Yeah, like sometimes you'll see like somebody takes a sentence out of a dissenting opinion and uses that to support their point. And it might be a valid point, but that doesn't mean that that's what the case supports.
Yeah, 14th Amendment. The people who support the 14th Amendment applying to everyone do exactly that. They take some of the seminal quotes from the not the actual opinion, from the dissents, and say, see, this is what it means. It's like, no.
Awesome. All right, so let's get back to the income tax. I get a lot of these questions asked to me, so I want to get your your position or your opinion. Some of them are facts, some of them are opinion. What does the income tax actually pay for?
The interest on the national debt.
Okay. Does it pay for... so I've tried to like look for... I've tried to add that up. I think they collect something like... Is it $3 trillion every year in income tax?
Something in that ballpark. I haven't looked up the number in a few years.
So that would, and the national debt's about 22 trillion, something like that. So yeah. When I try to calculate the interest, I'm like, okay, so either they're paying like 10-15% per year, or there's something else. And like a lot of people would say that this money is used for the military. So it's military plus interest.
It's not used for the military. No. And remember, the debt from things like, say, World War II in Korea has never been paid. So you've got compounding interest. Mm-hmm. The United States government has never been able to pay off anything. Was it Polk's administration? I forget which president it was the last president to actually pay the debt down to zero. So the United States didn't owe a penny. So we've got essentially compounding interest, which makes it exponentially harder to figure because you've got to go back to what the earliest debt is and figure out the interest on that and then move forward.
Right. Yeah, that's a good point. So if some of those debts are still outstanding, then obviously it's almost like we're creating new debt and still just paying the old debt with all the money that comes in.
Correct. Yeah, it's absolutely insane. And the only thing that allows it to be sustainable is that the bankers are laughing, ironically, all the way to the bank. Right. So they're willing to let this absurdity go. If this was a legitimate business transaction, the banks would be like, you're cut off, dude. You need to pay us off or you're done. Right, right. But because it's sovereign debt, so they're like, whatever, carry on.
Right. And you know, I kind of look at this like, you know, my position on a lot of this debt is we just need to say we can't pay it and we won't pay it, especially to creditors like the Federal Reserve. Because if you look at it, the Federal Reserve, which they didn't even really lend money, but let's for the sake of argument say they lent money to the United States government. You know, what would it make sense if a bank lent money to the mafia, knowing that, you know, because you always use the source of income as a measure for how much you can lend, what's their borrowing capacity. How much money would you lend to the mafia knowing that their only source of income is stealing from people? And eventually one day they might get caught, they might get busted, some people are going to go to jail and they're not going to be able to steal from people anymore. How much money would a bank lend them? And I would have to think that that's pretty next to zero.
Yes. And it's so funny because as you're telling that story, I'm like, you're describing, when you talk about the mafia, you're exactly describing the government, except there's no back end on that. Like there's the mafia.
Right.
The mafia can get arrested, prosecuted, and sent to prison. The government does the exact same thing without that back end. Yeah.
Right. Awesome. Okay. So when it comes to the income tax, I know there's a lot of discussion about who it actually applies to. And if it does only apply to, let's say, corporations, does that mean that that's a legitimate use for it? And then let's kind of talk about, I guess, let's just talk about that in general. Like, so it applies to some people, it doesn't apply to other things. Who's it actually intended for?
Okay. I don't know if you go back to, say, 1911, 1912, as it was being discussed, I don't know who it was intended to be applied to. What I know is, starting in 1913 and going through all the way to this very moment, who it has in fact been applied to in law by Congress. And that is three classes of persons. And that is U.S. citizens residing abroad with foreign earned income, foreign corporations deriving U.S. source income, and non-resident aliens deriving U.S. source income. That is it. If a person is not in one of those three categories, Congress has never imposed the income tax on them. And that I tell you, I was just discussing in a video the other day that because Americans in their little pea brains have been so badly programmed by the social false narrative, the biggest obstacle, Matt, that income tax shattering this has, as you said, you read it and you went, oh, I get it, right? That's not the problem. The problem is so many Americans are such knuckleheads. They've been programmed. They don't even realize they've been programmed that when they hear about the book, they won't buy it and read it because, well, that must be wrong. Get this. If my accountant didn't tell me that, then that book must be wrong.
Right.
It's an absurdity.
You know, reading through your book, I don't know if you mentioned the exact, I think you said something similar, but, you know, I sometimes I tell people, like, well, next time you go to see your accountant, why don't you ask them how much of the actual tax code that they've read? Because, like you point out, is they don't really read the tax code. They just kind of learn how to do the calculations, what's deductible, what's not, and all these other things. And it's kind of I say kind of the same thing about police, where the police don't usually learn the law. They usually learn procedure. How do you stop somebody? How do you give them a ticket? Here's a list of things you can cite them for. But they don't always know, like, the laws and everything behind that.
Very true.
And, you know, I think it's the same thing with a lot of accountants who are just, you know, they haven't read the tax code, even as confusing as it is, who would want to. But those are the people who are we're paying to do our taxes and trusting that they're going to do things right.
Yeah. And I don't know if you remember, this is a small detail from the book. I said that within subtitle A, chapters 1 and 2 are what I call the rules of computation. If somebody's liable, this is how you figure their taxes. That's all accountants and CPAs and tax attorneys know, is chapters 1 and 2, which is how you do the computations. Chapter 3, which talks about upon whom Congress has imposed the tax, they don't know anything about.
Right. And that's really interesting. I mean, it's you know, that's like you walk into the office and say, do I have to pay this? And they just say, well, do you have an income? And there's never that question of, okay, but does that really apply to anybody? You know, it doesn't make any sense. And what's really interesting is, like, obviously you can ask a question, does a Mexican or a Canadian who lives in their, you know, their home country, works in their home country and earns money, do they have to pay the income tax to the United States? And if you're asked that question, you're like, of course not. They're not in the United States. What sense does that make? But it's like, okay, so then it doesn't really apply to everyone, right? So there's some sort of jurisdictional restriction, or there's got to be some definition in there somewhere that says who.
Yeah.
It's not just everybody, right? So we have to ask what that is.
You know, when you talk about definitions, and that is, of course, as you well know from reading the book, that is one of the seminal parts of the scam. So, for instance, this thing I'm sitting in that swivels and it has a platform for my rear end and it's got legs and a back to it. If Congress wanted, for the purpose of some law, it could call this thing a cat. That we typically think of as a feline, right? And people would say, oh, this tax applies to cats, felines. No. Because if you read if then you go 75 pages later to the definition section and you read how they define cat, like, say, a platform for your ass and a vertical upright for your back, and it's got four legs. Well, wait a second. In real people talk, that's a chair. Okay. So that's an extreme example. But Congress is free to define these words to mean whatever they want them to mean. And they have. Most of the words, probably, you know, up in the high 90 percentile that are used in the tax code, mean something entirely different than what the average American thinks they mean. You know, I love it. IRS publications, right, supposed to be written in plain English for the average person, which it is. But the words still mean what the words in the publication right. still mean what it says over here in the statute, which has very specific definitions, which are not what the guy reading the publications thinks it means. It's a scam from the word go.
Right. And what's interesting is if you go over to I usually use this law.cornell.edu, which is really great because they'll actually highlight the words. Like, yes. I'm looking at the tax code right now, section 3401. And for employee, if I click on it, it shows me the actual definition of employee in that section related to this section right here. So that's a really great tool. But of course, that's not available on the IRS's.
No, that's a relatively new feature from Cornell, and yeah. I really like it.
Yeah, it is, and it's pretty awesome.
Yeah.
So there's a couple questions coming through. I just want to get these. So Joel is asking where he can get the book. I guess he's only seen used copies on Amazon, which are pretty expensive. The book's still in print and available on your website, right?
Yes. But by the way, I love it when I go on Amazon and type it in. It's like $300 for a used copy. It's like, go. Okay. But no, you don't have to pay that. It's on special right now. All you have to do is go to DaveChampionsLiberty.com. DaveChampionsLiberty.com. Up at the top, you'll see a series of choices. Click on book. Right now, the special is you get the book. I inscribe it. I autograph it, no robo signing. I do it all personally. I sit down every night, inscribe books, and autograph them. And I send you one of the things that I think is the most valuable. It's a 2-hour video I created 2 years ago that talks about my experiences and the experiences of my clients over 15 years of me assisting people who know the truth about the income tax, how to succeed financially in a world where, of course, American citizens are idiots.
All right. So I want to hop back over to definitions since we're talking about that. There's a really great one that I love, which is the word voluntary, which they use. Is this actually defined anywhere? Because I know they use this and they've totally changed the definition. Like, no, it's compulsory, but we like to use the word voluntary.
Yeah. Voluntary is a word that they throw out politically. It doesn't appear in the code, and if you'd like, at some point, I can explain how they mean it.
Right. Yeah. Let's go ahead and explain it for anyone that doesn't know.
Okay. So for a person who is required to fill out a W-4 when they go to work, by the way, which is not 98% of you watching this broadcast. Okay. And again, that's all in the book, so you don't have to take my word for it. As a matter of fact, I consistently say, and Matt, you remember at the beginning of the book, please do not take my word for this. Look this shit up for yourself. I'm the guide, but I want you to look it up for yourself. Okay, so the W-4 or a W-9, which if you're in business for yourself in America and you've been asked 1,000 times to fill out W-9s, and you have, you need to get the book and realize that you're killing yourself by breaking the law that way. The IRS will let you break the law, but you're breaking the law and you're hurting
in their
yourself.
Favor.
Oh, in the IRS's favor, right, which is why they're like, oh, wrong guy, no problem. So anyway, that part where you declare that you are a person upon whom Congress has imposed a tax or otherwise made you liable, when you fill out a W-9 or fill out a W-4, there's nobody standing over you with handcuffs saying, if you don't fill this out, we're going to take you to jail. That's the voluntary part. But if you are a person, the tiny percentage of people who are required to fill out a W-4, or the tiny percentage of people who are required to fill out a W-9, what comes after that is not voluntary in the least. So that moment when the government is saying, hey, raise your hand and declare yourself, that's the voluntary moment.
So let's talk about that for a minute. I've tried this myself when I have an employer, especially a big corporation has got thousands of employees, and they're saying, here, fill out the W-2. And I'm like, I'm not a U.S. person by the definition. Send them the statute. I don't want to fill this out. I don't have to fill this out. And then they get really upset and they start to argue, well, you have to fill it out, and no explanation. They just start going crazy and go, well, if you don't want the job, then, you know, go fuck off. But what kind of advice do you have to somebody in that position? Is there a way around that? Is there something you can tell these people?
There's a couple of ways. First of all, I want to be very clear that if somebody was a client of mine 15, 16, 18 years ago, and they're going to, when I speak now, they're going to be like, I cannot believe, because that's not the advice he gave me then. We get older, we get more mature. Okay, so back then, I have to come clean and say that basically my thing was, okay, the law is on our side 100%, inarguably crystal clear. There is not even room for debate. So I'm going to shove it down your throat. Okay? I don't hold that point of view anymore. Gotten older, and so I understand now that business, life, which business is a subset of life, is about relationships. So really the way to go about it is to be engaging, to have a smile on your face, to make them want to sit and talk with you because you're so pleasant and you have such a great sense of humor about this and you have all the law at your fingertips. And every time you show them a law, you know, there's smiles and some laughter about it. You know, you make a joke. That's how we get through to people. Okay? Now, I had tremendous success 15 years ago helping people. But if I took the approach I just shared with you now, there would have even been a higher rate of success. Because that's how you motivate people, is to make them feel that you're not their enemy. But that doesn't eviscerate their feelings of being concerned that they have their corporate structure that they have to satisfy. And that's where you get into things like using letters of release where you release them from any liability and so forth. There's a whole bunch of things that you can do. And this does not work in 100% of the cases. Let me be clear. You can't just win 100% of the time when 99% of the people are idiots. Okay? Your goal is to make the company feel as comfortable, secure, and safe accommodating you as they can feel. Okay. So one of the things that's very common in the tax honesty community is to say, you know, now here's my affidavit. You better do what the hell I say. Okay. not a good approach. The law should be secondary. Okay. Hey, I want to sit down and talk with you about something. You know, I've been looking at this for years. I live by it. I'm 100% convicted. And if you knew what I knew, you would be too. So I'd like to take a few minutes and sit down and chat with you about it. Okay. That's your intro. Not, do you see the law? Okay. That's not it.
Right.
So there, again, you know, everybody's got their own permutations. Some people work for small businesses. Some people work for medium, large. Some people, the boss knows all. I've sat down with somebody on behalf of a client and the boss was like, oh, this is what you want to talk about? Yeah, I'm totally down with that. So
right.
Depends on who you're talking to.
Yeah, especially with small businesses. I mean, you know, I grew up working for small businesses that were just kind of like, oh, yeah, you want to get paid cash? Like, you know, they were totally fine with not reporting anything to the IRS and just doing it that way. So yeah, it's obviously it's when you get to the bigger corporations, they're usually more worried about like, well, we've got a lot more to lose. If the IRS comes down, we've got a multi-million dollar company. I'm just the HR department. I've got lawyers that I have to, you know, all this other stuff. So yeah, obviously the smaller it is, the easier it is. And the bigger it is, the more complicated it can get. So
yeah, by the way, let me just say, when I used to do this on behalf of clients, so somebody would say what you just said, look, I'm just the HR person. I've got people that I'm accountable to. So I'm not going to be able to go with you on this. I would say, I totally understand. May I take this off your plate? Who is it that I should be speaking to so you don't feel any pressure?
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, again, that's a great strategy.
As comfortable as you can make them.
So let's talk about, I want to talk about employees and officers of a corporation and all this other stuff. So in one of the sections, 3401, it talks about employees and withholding. This is in the withholding section. And it says any employer has to withhold from an employee. And then it defines an employee. And I'm reading this straight from the code. For the purposes of this chapter, the term employee includes an officer, employee, or elected official of the United States, a state, or any political subdivision thereof, or the District of Columbia, or any agency of instrumentality, or any one or more of the foregoing. The term employee also includes an officer of a corporation. Does this include an employee of a corporation? So somebody proposed this to me in an interesting way by saying a corporation is, I think he used, let's see, what's one of the ones? An instrumentality of the government. It's something that's kind of, it's a special privilege or legal entity created in cooperation with the government. So does a corporation kind of fit that description? And as an employee, let's say you're flipping burgers for McDonald's, does that make you now an employee of an instrumentality of a governmental entity?
No, not at all. Let me explain how this works. We've got subtitle A, which imposes the liability and otherwise makes certain people liable. You've got subtitle C, which is withholding of income at source, which is what we're talking about with 3401C. Okay, that's in subtitle C, different subtitles, right? But subtitle C is Congress authorizing government entities within Article 1, Section 8, Clause 17 of the Constitution to take property out of people's paychecks. Okay? So what that is it is a command to government agencies. If you are Article 1, Section 8, Clause 17, which is basically D.C., the possessions and territories, if you're a government agency in any of those and you have a certain kind of person working for you, we hereby command you to have them fill out a W-4, and then you shall deduct and withhold. When we get to the part about includes an officer of a corporation, that falls under a Latin doctrine called agem generis, which means that a vague thing that follows, we're just as officers of a corporation, that's vague, right? It has to be seen in light of the more specific thing above, which is where they give all the details about an officer, employee, elected official of the United States government, blah, okay, and so forth. Okay. So, for instance, who is that officer of that corporation? That would be a federal or other government instrumentality, such as the United States Post Office. What's the mortgage company? Freddie Mac.
Yep.
Okay. That is actually Congress owns Freddie Mac. Okay. So that's the officers they're talking about. So any instrumentality that has been created to serve a governmental function under Article 1, Section 8, Clause 17 is subject to 3401C.
Interesting. So this would not correct me if I'm wrong. It sounds like you're saying if you have a corporation, let's use the McDonald's example or Walmart, those officers are then not considered employees because they're working for corporations that are not government corporations. Is that right?
No, let's just use Walmart as an example. It doesn't matter whether we're talking about the door greeters, or I guess I should call them receipt demanders now. Doesn't matter whether we're talking about them or we're talking about one of the Walton families who is a president of one of their divisions. None of those fall within the scope of 3401C. And wow. Walmart is not the employer at 3401D.
Interesting. Okay.
It's all instructions from Congress authorizing all of those government entities, all of them. So, for instance, a municipal government on Guam, okay, has permission, if their employees are of a particular type, has permission to take their property out of their paycheck. That's it. Nobody else.
And give it to the feds. And that's an interesting distinction also, because a lot of people don't realize that like when we hear the word corporation, we think of McDonald's and Walmart, but cities, police departments, fire departments, they can all be corporations. Every government entity can be its own corporation. And it's the same kind of, well, it's not the same, but it's there are a lot of similarities with that and a business. But it is in fact a corporation under that title, corporation. So
yes, but it retains its status as a government agency.
Right.
Yeah.
So, okay, cool. So, I want to talk about the,
oh, by the way, one more thing.
Yeah.
When we talk about corporations that are instrumentalities, the test is who are the shareholders.
So here's an interesting question. What if there's a corporation that's owned in part by government and in part by private individuals?
If the corporation was established by the government and the government was the first and primary shareholder, it remains a government agency, unless Congress has passed a law declaring it is no longer.
Right. Okay. Interesting. So that makes so the government couldn't go along and purchase one share of Walmart and say, haha, it's now a government agency.
No. For instance, the government was the owner of most of the railroads if you go back to the late 1800s. But Congress held on to some of the stocks for quite a number of decades, even after they'd given up their jurisdictional control over the railroads.
Interesting. Okay. So since we're talking about corporations, there are a few other things. One thing I've seen a lot of people arguing on the internet is that the criminal failure to file statutes only apply to officers of a corporation. Okay, let's go there. And of course, like from what we've already talked about, is that any individual is not really considered a tax, or not the tax hasn't been levied on every individual in the first place. So, what is this? What is this argument that I see around?
It's people. So many incorrect arguments concerning the income tax. It's people trying to find a way to shove their understanding in, or shove the facts into their narrow understanding and getting it wrong. It's been really, really common. One of the people I loved to death was Erwin Schiff. I call him the grandfather of the tax honesty movement, but I have nothing but respect and appreciation for the trail that he cut. Ultimately, though, his position, there was no law requiring anyone to file an income tax return, was wrong. We saw the consequences for him of being wrong. This is similar to how it is with people who make this argument. They're doing their best. No ill will towards them. They're doing their best. They're just mistaken. So here's the deal. Only people who've been made liable specifically by statute, had the tax imposed on them, or otherwise been made liable, two separate categories, are required to file returns. If you're not one of those two people, the whole willful failure to file statute, it doesn't even apply to you. It's like a French statute. There's actually a French law that says unless you fatten a duck by force feeding it grain, you cannot declare it the product of its liver to be a certain kind of French product. Okay, does that apply to you and I? So it's the same exact thing with the willful failure to file. You have to be a person upon whom Congress has imposed the tax, or a person that Congress has made liable. I said that a couple of times, so let me take a quick 5 seconds and explain that. The income tax is one of the only taxes in existence where, Matt, you can be made liable. I know another gentleman with your last name, whose name Matt. I apologize. Daniel. I've said that several times. I just realized what I was doing. Let's say, Daniel, you have been made Congress has imposed the tax on you. But because it's non-resident aliens, one of the three categories, you're in Paraguay earning U.S. source income. I'm the U.S. person who's handling the flow of income from whatever investment to you in Paraguay. Now, Congress quite rightfully knows if I pass all that money on to Daniel in Paraguay and the IRS says, hey, Daniel, where's the payments? You're going to be like, dude, I'm in Paraguay. Okay. You're not getting anything. I got my money. Screw you. So Congress very wisely made what I call the last domestic person with it liable. So while the tax has been imposed on Daniel, I'm liable because I'm the last domestic guy with it. I have to file the return. I have to pay Daniel's tax before I send the balance off to Daniel in Paraguay. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay. So that's the difference between liable, have it imposed, and made liable.
Okay. So let's talk about Wesley Snipes, because that one, after looking at, I looked at his indictment, and what I saw in there was I saw charges for money laundering. There were several corporations involved. It wasn't just he was receiving a paycheck from a movie studio. There was a lot more to that whole case. What do you think is, and then of course, you know, the propaganda on TV was just saying like, no, he just didn't want to pay his taxes. So that's why the IRS went after him, making us all afraid. Well, if you don't pay your taxes, you're going to end up like Wesley Snipes.
Right.
What do you think is kind of the big issue with his case that made it different from, I mean, obviously there are a lot of reasons, but what do you think is kind of the linchpin that made that different than what the normal American goes through?
First of all, Wesley Snipes, let's go back. The lion's share of people, probably 99% of the people who get prosecuted for tax evasion or willful failure to file, they actually believe they owed the tax. And with that belief system in their head, they were in fact cheating. They were in fact breaking the law by their own mental construct. Does that make sense? Okay. Right. Wesley Snipes did not fit that profile. Wesley Snipes believed he did not owe a penny, that the tax had not been imposed upon him and he had not been made liable. Sadly, he based his entire position on a faulty argument known as the 861 position. Now, that was first championed, I don't know, 20 years ago by Thurston Bell. And then Thurston Bell sort of left the scene, and Larkin Rose, somebody who you're well familiar with, Larkin Rose picked up the 861 argument and did a fantastic, masterful job at marketing it all across the country. Problem was, it's legally faulty. And the government knew that, and people like me knew that. And so when Wesley was indicted, Hollywood folks always have people, right? So his people reached out to me and they said, will you be on the defense team for Wesley? And I said, maybe. I'm more than happy to help. And I believe we can make this entire matter go away. Now, mind you, he'd already been indicted. We can make this entire matter go away. But if you want to do that with me, you have to get rid of this 861 thing, because that is death. He's going to jail if you pursue that. And his people told me, oh, well, 861 is the hill that he's prepared to die on. Okay, thanks for calling. We know how that story ended. I was not willing to attach my name to a completely bogus legal proposition. So I was happy to help. And by the way, people who know the law, what's in income tax shattering the myths, never, ever, first of all, they never hear from the IRS at all. If they do what's in the book, they follow the rules of the game. Just like football, right? If you're on a football field, what rules must you follow? You're not following the rules of tennis, right? If you're on the football field.
Right.
So if you understand the law, I'm over here on this field, Congress has never imposed a tax on me, then you can't start doing the things that are in the football rule book. So if you stay on your own playing field and follow the rules, you'll never even hear from the IRS, no less criminal investigation, no less indictment, none of that. And the reason is the IRS and most specifically the tax division of DOJ does not want to take anyone to a criminal trial that has the correct legal argument. They have never, in the entire history of the income tax, what are we at, 104, 105 years now?
Yep.
They have never once taken a person with the correct legal argument to court. Think about that. Never once. And the reason is they're happy to let millions of us go so that they don't have to argue the actual real law in court. Wesley Snipes was arguing a bogus point of law, easy for them to strike down. If you're following the actual laws that Congress wrote, government has no interest in you at all. They're more than happy to let you go.
All right. So let's say somebody reads your book, they find out about this, but they've already got their W-4, W-2 filled out or W-9. What are their options then? Can you cancel a W-4 that's been filled out? Can you get your employer to correct something, or can you dispute whatever they report to the IRS? Can that be disputed with the IRS?
Of course. Imagine a 5-year-old that sees the equation 2 + 2, and having a 5-year-old mind, he says, oh, 2 + 2, that equals 22. When the child goes to school and learns that 2 + 2 is 4, the child is not in any way obligated to continue to say it's 22 because they once did, right? Same thing is true with tax law. If you fill out a W-4, a W-9, because you thought, you never read the law, you never looked into it, you didn't know, you thought you had to, you believe that guy over there who told you you had to. When you learn otherwise, you can stop doing it. The issue is you need to unwind that. And that's a that's a process I can't get into here. We'd be here for hours. And there are some people, there's a page on Facebook called the Tax Honesty Patriots. I always suggest to people they go this route. They get a copy of Income Tax Shattering the Myths. They read it cover to cover. If they feel the need, which many people do, to make sure they really have it up here, and it's trapped in their mind, read it to it twice. Then go join the Tax Honesty Patriots and start a dialogue with the hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people there who are well-seasoned, years of experience, who can help guide you to be successful.
Okay. So I guess the easy answer to that is that there is a way out. You definitely want to read the book and then talk to some others and make sure you have, figure out the strategy to make that happen. But it is possible to get out of that hole.
Yeah. By the way, let me make sure, because there's always that guy, right? Don't think you're going to be the shortcut and don't read the book and then go to the group and ask for help, because I can tell you from years of experience in that group, they will tell you, no, until you've read the book, you're wasting our time. So don't try and cheat, read the book.
All right. So I'm looking through some of these questions here that are coming in. Let's see. The federal income tax is imposed upon the taxable income of aliens, both non-resident and resident aliens and foreign corporations.
Not resident aliens.
Not resident aliens.
For the purpose of the income tax, resident aliens are treated the exact same way as our U.S. citizens.
Interesting. Okay. Do you think this is a fair statement? CFR 1.1441(1)(c)(3), the term individual is defined as alien individual, non-resident alien individual for tax purposes under subtitle A income tax.
I agree. It says that. Was there a question beyond, does it really say that?
Do you think it's a fair statement? No, that sounds about it. So, well, I guess. Good.
Let me be cautious. Let me issue a word of caution about the word individual. Okay. That definition is in Chapter 3 of the code. Okay, we talked about that. Remember, chapters 1 and 2 are the rules of computation. Chapter 3 gives you the broad outline and specific details of who it applies to. So that's in Chapter 3. It's important that you understand when you're, for instance, in Chapters 1 and 2, individual means a singular person. It doesn't have the same meaning as it does in Chapter 3. So we have to keep in mind when it says for the purpose of this subtitle or the purpose of this chapter or even sometimes the purpose of this section or subsection, that we don't carry a meaning of individual outside the area that it was applied to by Congress or by the agency in this case, since he's referring to a rank. So just a cautionary note there.
Okay. So yeah, I guess that answers that question. Let's see.
But yeah, by the way, I should say that definition that he just cited is one of the linchpin elements of correctly understanding the tax.
And an interesting point I think you brought up in the book was that the chapters, so the chapters A and B that you were talking about, and chapter C where it actually defines who the tax is imposed on, is the name of that chapter is something to do with non-resident or with aliens or foreign something.
Yes. Chapter 3 is, if I can remember after all these years, tax upon non-resident aliens and foreign corporations, which is why it's so funny, because like you sit down, you talk to an accountant, right? You're trying to educate an accountant. You go, okay, look at Chapter 1. Okay, you know, normal and surtaxes. Chapter 2, okay. And you say, okay, Chapter 3 is it where it tells you upon whom the tax has been imposed. So they go, no, this is non-resident aliens and foreign corporations. And you're like, yeah. And they're like, no, that's not for who it applies. It's because we're programmed to believe that it applies to the average American working person. When you show a person Chapter 3 and it's entitled non-resident aliens and foreign corporations, they won't even read it because they're so... without knowing anything about tax law, they're absolutely certain that's not who it's imposed upon.
Right.
What do you do with that? Right.
And it's, you know, it's, I could see someone, you know, sitting there saying like, well, can you just look at chapter C for a second? And they could just read the title and say, well, that doesn't apply to you. You're not a foreign corporation, right? So why, we don't even need to go in there.
Right. Why are you there? Yeah.
So, all right. So, Donnie's coming on right now. He's asking, what's the name of the book? I've actually got it on the screen here, but, it's Income Tax Shattering the Myth. And I got my copy here and I just want to check. Yeah. Hey, it is. I got mine autographed. awesome. So yeah, this is an awesome, awesome book. I definitely recommend it. And Dave, I got,
by the way, did you just show off my horrible penmanship?
I think it's too light in here that it showed up all white. So,
but okay, hey, good.
Honestly, it's 50 times better than mine. So I'm not going to say anything. So let me ask you outside, because we talk about, okay, there is this tax and there are people who it actually applies to. And I'm sitting here saying taxation is theft. All taxation is theft. You know, even if it applies to foreign corporations, they're still stealing. Do you believe that taxation is theft?
I believe that taxation is citizen approved theft. Here's what I tell people all the time. And your audience may disagree with me vehemently. I believe that the vast majority of Americans, when the glass breaks at 3 o'clock in the morning and they hear voices outside in the room outside their bedroom, they want, passionately want, government enforcement agents with tasers and batons and guns and rifles and shotguns to show up. I believe that when Mary and her husband are sitting at the dinner table and Ralph keels over grabbing his chest, oh my God, call 911. They want trained individuals to show up and save Ralph's life. And we could go on and on. Okay. And I understand that in the libertarian community, there's a lot of talk about privatization. Some of my dearest friends feel passionately about that. Let's take the fire department, for an example. That's often used as an object of privatization. However, Americans, we don't read history, right, Daniel? And if people read history, they would know that the experiment in privatization of fire services was a complete disaster, which is why it ended up being a government service for which people pay property tax. So I guess my point is I respect the view that all of that should be privatized and taxation is theft, and I understand where people are coming from. And how about this? In pure theory, they're right. But the problem is people. Most people don't want what you and I want, Daniel. Most people are sheeple. And the sheeple demand that we pay tribute so that the sheeple can get what they want from the government.
Right. I think that's pretty fair. And I think, you know, I spend a lot of time trying to figure things out so that, because there are those services that we want. We do want fire and police. We do want to be able to call someone if there's an emergency. Of course, we want those to be, as the word republic means, we want that to be a public thing where we can call and use that service and they're not just out patrolling and, you know, looking for trouble where there isn't any and you know, finding a way to use that to extort us. But I think that's pretty fair. That is along the lines. And I think as long as we're trying to figure out a way that we can get rid of the excess theft and figure out how we can come upon some sort of voluntary way to fund the things that we all do want, then, you know, as long as we're trying, which I think a lot of the sheeple kind of give up on that and say, well, let's just pay the government and let them figure it out, because those politicians are, they're brilliant people. They're very smart. They'll figure out everything for us.
Now, can I draw a distinction to sure. The income tax?
Yeah.
The income tax is the only tax that, if it applied the way the sheeple think it applies, actually takes a percentage of your labor, that it doesn't belong to you. Now, we know, we were raised understanding that if somebody else owns 100% of your labor, you're a slave. I don't think anybody questions that. You know, we in America, we have a history of slavery. So that's a very poignant thing we're all aware of. So I like to ask people, at what percentage that where someone else owns your labor, are you not a slave? 100% is a slave. 99% slave, not slave. 89%, 82%, 79%. At what point do you cease being a slave beneath 100%? Okay. One of the things that people will find in Income Tax Shattering the Myths is that the Supreme Court of the United States has ruled, and repeatedly, that you have a right, a fundamental right to earn a living. You have a fundamental right to contract for your labor, and you have a fundamental right to seek somebody else's contract for labor. We all know we were raised in school. We know that a poll tax is illegal, right? Because it imposes a tax on a right. That's not even a fundamental right. That's what the law considers a political right, which is considered a lesser than fundamental right, right? If you cannot tax a political right, you sure as hell can't tax a fundamental right, because as the court said so succinctly, the power to tax is the power to destroy. So if Congress had the power that the masses of ignorant Americans believe it had to tax our labor, then it would have the power to destroy our ability to exist. Here's another doctrine in law established by the court, well settled. Once the legislature, any legislature, has the power to tax a thing, the rate at which it taxed that thing is completely at the discretion of the legislature, and no other branch of government can interfere. So if what the masses believe of Congress is true, that they had the right to tax our labor, they could tax our labor. They would have the legal prerogative, the power to tax our labor at 100%. It means they would have the ability to remove our ability to buy clothes, food, shelter, medicine, things for our children. Does anyone really believe the founders gave the federal government that any government, but we're talking about the federal government here, gave the federal government the authority, the power to completely destroy your ability to maintain yourself? Think of the founders, Thomas Jefferson, James Madison, George Washington. Does anybody in the right mind think they gave Congress that power? And no, the 16th Amendment didn't do it either, and I discussed that in detail in the book.
Right. So I want to bring up, because we talk about property tax, and I really used to hold the exact same view that, you know, it's that the income tax is slavery, and I wouldn't say that it's not. But what I found to be even more is, so if you look at what slavery is, right, we have this concept that it's owning people, right? And so then, of course, if you're taxing their income, you are taking part of their labor as if you own that person. But what is the real purpose of slavery? Why did, you know, people who owned cotton fields, why did they want slaves? They didn't want to own people. They had no, you know, there was no status that they have. Oh, I own 500 people. Maybe there was some people bragging about that. But the intent that they had was, I want these people to work on my fields. I want the free labor. Mm-hmm. And so if you think about that, what if you lived in a society where somebody had this farm and they had no people to work on that farm for them, and they needed labor, and they could offer money, but nobody wanted to take it because, you know, they were off living their own lives. They built their own homesteads. They grew their own food. They didn't need jobs. How would you take somebody and force them to work on your property? Now, you could go and capture them and turn them into, you know, chattel slaves, which is your property, and force them to work. But what if you could do that economically? And that's where I see the property tax is even more damaging, because in the United States, whether you're renting or whether you own property, you're paying property tax. If you're renting, you're paying your landlord's property tax. Mm-hmm. And so that property tax has to be paid in money. So you can have a piece of land, you can build your own house, you can grow your own food, but ultimately you can't pay your property tax unless you now go into town and get a job, and you're being forced to work for somebody else so that you can now have money to pay for this property tax. So we talked about how the property tax pays for a lot of these other services like police and fire and everything else. But what's really interesting is that one, I think, is is, you know, if you got rid of the income tax completely and only had property tax, I think that in conjunction with some of the other laws that they have, like, you know, you can't drill a well, you can't collect rainwater, you can't have farm animals in certain places, or, you know, all these different rules restricting you, your ability to live without dependency on somebody else giving you money. I think that in itself is kind of it's not owning somebody, but it's forcing them to labor into a system. What do you think about that?
I think it sounds very much like the phrase from the 13th Amendment, involuntary servitude.
Right. It's involuntary now, by a very roundabout way.
Yeah, exactly. But and let's go back to where property taxes started, right? Property taxes started because as far as our version of property taxes, right, here in the United States, before it was the United States, when it belonged to the crown, right? The idea was, the legal theory, the legal doctrine that underpinned property taxes was that everything belonged to the king, right? Every acre or every hectare belonged to the king. So the king would say, Daniel, I'm going to make you the landlord, if you will, the overseer of these 200,000 acres. And because I'm going to allow you to prosper, you're going to get your serfs on the land, and you're going to be able to get whatever the rewards are you get from overseeing this productive land. You're going to pay me X amount. So the concept of property tax in the beginning was you were paying the king for the privilege that he was bestowing upon you concerning that land. Now, I don't know if you're aware, there's a Supreme Court case early on, I can't recall the name as we sit here talking now, where the court said when the states became states after the treaty with England, after the Revolutionary War, that the power that had formerly belonged to the King of England now became resident in the citizenry of the state. So in a sense now, if you got to kind of go with me on this,
all this
group called the citizens of the states now have the powers of the king. So they say, in a sense, since you're in this jurisdiction called, I don't know, the state of Illinois, we say, because we're the king now, all of us, you have to put some in the common pool. You have to throw some in the pot for all of us to share for common needs. I think that is a fair assessment of how it started and where it is, legally speaking, the theoretical legal side of it. If people find that objectionable, I certainly understand. But I think that lays out kind of how we got here.
Right. Yeah, and that's always really interesting to know how did we get here, because it's not always just a matter of, yeah, we don't like this thing, we should get rid of it. It's how did we get, especially, you know, with the income tax, it's how did we get here, because it is kind of, you know, if we can look at that and say, well, you're not really in there. If you educate yourself and look at it a little bit differently, everything kind of changes, and you can understand that, okay, so how much of this needs to actually change legally, and how much of it already legally doesn't even apply to you, and you shouldn't be concerned with it. I think that's all really interesting perspective on all of that.
Yeah, and John Adams, obviously one of the more well-known founders, he said, and I paraphrase, if the day ever comes that the right of property as seen as anything less than the word of God, because he was a Christian, okay, then that's going to bring woeful times for our country. But even in his time, it was never presumed that that should embrace taxes on property, which is obviously a right. Yes, you have the right to own it, and the power to tax is the power to destroy. So in theory, the government has the right to destroy your ability to own that property. It seems to be there's this whole big framework of law about our rights, except for property tax. that somehow sits outside that entire framework of logic.
Yeah, it is really interesting. And you know what? Something else that you mentioned in your book actually was, I think you talked a lot about business taxes and licenses and business licenses. And one thing that was interesting was, I think you said something, and correct me if I'm wrong, something about if you don't have a corporation, in many cases, you don't need a business license for most businesses.
That is correct. A business license, here, I'll tell you an interesting story. This is a true story, goes back, hell, I don't know, 25 years ago. In Southern California, some friends of mine, married couple, they owned a business, and they rented some new space. And the city inspector or somebody came by and said, you need to get a business license. So they went and did all their research on what the Supreme Court had said about the right to earn a living, and it cannot be taxed and so forth. And so they went down and they used that model that I was sharing earlier, very gracious, very kind, very endearing. I'm just going to show you what the law says because I know you wouldn't want to violate what the Supreme Court said, right? And eventually what the city acknowledged was, yeah, you're right, but here's the thing. The fire marshal can't come in and do an inspection unless you have a business license. And because you have contiguous property with other businesses, they are at risk if the fire marshal can't inspect your business. So the deal the city made was, we won't make you pay anything if you'll just get it. We'll even write in there it's for the sole purpose of fire inspection. Okay? Wow. So even these governments actually know. The question is, you know, what kind of a douche are you dealing with?
Right. Yeah, that's really interesting. And, you know, you look at some cities like New York, and I have to imagine that's, you'd be dealing with some pretty big douches.
Exactly. All right. Look, Daniel, Jen has come home. I told her I was taking her to dinner tonight. If you want to, you know, go for one last bite of the apple, if there's something that's on your mind, but we got to start to wrap up.
No, I think that's great. I really want to thank you for joining me on the show. If you want to get the book, go to DaveChampionsLiberty.com/book. And is there anything else you want to plug or mention?
I do. I've got a new book coming out very shortly, dealing with health and nutrition. Now, if people are just yawning about this, don't, because I'm going to tell you that the BS you've been fed about health and nutrition for the last 6 years is just as apply to the vast majority of Americans. So, if
I could be, hang on a second, we got an audio issue. I don't think you can hear me. This is the worst possible time for that to happen. So, here's what I'm going to do. I don't know if you can still hear me, but the audio just really cut out on that for a second. It looks like you're now it's starting to come back now. But I lost you right at the beginning where you were talking about you know, everything that we've learned about nutrition over the past 14 years.
You've been lied to just as much as about the income tax. That's the point I wanted to make. And this book sets all of that straight. Can you hear me now?
Yeah, it seems to be working now.
Okay. So if somebody wants to know the truth about that, just like the income tax, send an email to dave@drreality.news and just put subject line, new book, put your name in there. And in a couple of months when the book's available, I'll send you an email concerning the pre-release offer.
Awesome. And as my endorsement to that, obviously I haven't read the book yet, but I have seen your transformation and everything that you've been posting online kind of as you've been going through your kind of call that a nutritional process
over the
past while. So I've seen an amazing transformation. So I'm sure whatever you've got is really great information. And of course, I don't trust anything that comes out of the government's information machine on healthcare either. So I'm really interested to see what you got there.
And I should probably apologize to Matt Bergman. because he may not be a libertarian. He might be like, what is Champion doing? So I apologize to Matt and I apologize to you, Daniel.
No worries. Awesome. So thank you again for coming on the show. We'll have you back sometime and go get the book. Go send an email to Dave and we'll see you later. And Taxation is Theft.
Bye, buddy. Thank you.
Taxation is Theft.
Please, at least leave us alone in our living room.
My job is to find the truth.
Double the taxes.
I'm a human being. God damn it. My life has value.
Triple the taxes.
This is an IRS agent's dream.
If you think that the Capitol will ever treat us fairly, you are lying to yourself.
Beautiful, lovely taxes.
Sorry, but I don't do taxes.
Did you see the memo about this?
The government is a greedy piglet.
Just leave us alone.
Do you know what Ralph just said?
The roads.
You boys like Mexico!